But when it comes down to it, projects are about people. You know, people get projects done. Process doesn't get projects done. And so really paying attention to what do you bring to a project? What are the traits that you bring? What strengths do you have? And then what strengths do the people around you have? And really take a good look, because their strengths are not necessarily directly aligned with their function. So I have many, not to say that they're not good at their function. Like I've had programmers, you know, have been great programmers, but when you really sit down with them and explore their knowledge or explore their passion or explore their personality strengths, it turns out there are other things that they can contribute to the project that are really beneficial. And when you tap into those people become much more engaged because they feel so sort of seen and appreciated that they just do everything better. You know, they contribute more on all fronts in terms of their formal function and also the informal function of bringing their strengths to work.
Hi, and welcome to the Sunday Lunch Project Manager podcast for Sunday, the 20th of August 2023. This is your host, Nigel Creaser, and I'm away on my holiday still. And today we have a rerun of my interview with Ruth Pierce, the project motivator. Just a quick shout out, another way that I found that you could support the show, and there's some info in the show notes, is that it's the British Podcast Awards this year for their voting cuts off on the 5th of September for what they call the People's Choice. I have no delusions that I will not win it, but being voted for and maybe getting one on lists, I don't know whether they have specialised lists or anything like that, means that discoverability for the podcast would be improved, which is always the battle with getting the show out to people. So if you're inclined to vote for me, and actually you probably vote for others as well, I personally voted for the Social Distance Sports Bar podcast that I really enjoy. If you go along to British Pods 2023, for on my website, so nigelcreaser.com/britishpods2023, and then that will redirect you to the right page, and you search for me, the Sunday Lunch Project Manager. It should pop up, click on that, and then cast your vote and you verify it, things like that, and then you can vote for other ones as well if you want. So if you do that, I'd be very grateful, and tell your friends. Cheers now. So I have a number of sponsors, affiliate links, in the way that it's set up, that have kindly allowed me to share their services, really. The first one is Mike Lane, and Mike runs PM online PM courses, and it is a great resource for getting those fundamentals of project management trained, reasonably priced, and Mike presents it in an accessible and clear manner. You can check out some of his videos on his YouTube channel and kind of give you a view of where they are. But the code for that, if you go to nigelcreaser.com/online PM courses, all one word, lowercase, that'll redirect you to it. There's varying different levels that you can buy. You can buy individual courses, you can buy pathways as well, if you like. And I get a kickback off those. Mike kindly shares me that. So if you do jump on and use it, I hope you find it really useful. I think he has money back guarantees and things like that as well. So there's a very limited risk on that. So jump on that, and that again is nigelcreaser.com/online PM courses, and enjoy.
So today I've got Ruth Pierce. I'm going to give you a little bio about Ruth Pierce. For over 20 years, she has taken on large-scale projects in financial services, software houses, state government, education, and non-profit organizations. And in 2011, Ruth and the team were the winners of the PMI Distinguished Project Award. She had found a niche at that time. She also launched a book called Project Motivator recently called Unlock the Secrets of Strengths-Based Project Management. And one of the comments from Ken Blanchard on the book was, Ruth knows project management from the inside out. She knows the best project managers use their influence to engage their teams. And with that engagement comes motivation and commitment to the projects and to each other. Read Be a Project Motivator and Watch Your Project Teams Thrive. And I say again, that's from Ken Blanchard, a new 1 Minute Manager author. So another comment I've got there is, Ruth has always used evidence-based positive psychology techniques, particularly character strengths, to build resilient, high-performing teams. Now, she's a writer, speaker, a group team coach, and a certified coach trainer. And she's continued to project manage with a passion. She brings bravery, curiosity, fairness, appreciation, and gratitude to all she does. Her motto is be helpful, be strong, be brave, and be curious. So, Ruth, welcome to the Sunday Lunch Project podcast.
Thank you very much, Nigel. And that, it was weird listening to you introduce me. I'm like, is he talking about me? Yeah. But thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah. That's quite all right. It's I've seen a lot of your posts on Facebook and had a quick start reading of Project Motivator and intrigued to finish it as well. So it's an interesting point. And I think I may have talked to you before around the kind of interview I want to do on these interviews is really get behind the project managers that we deal with and not necessarily go into all the what are the tools we can use, what are the best way to do things. So we'll probably cover that and really find out a little bit about you and your background.
Okay.
Because I think a lot of that gives lessons to us all. So kind of a bit of background, where were you born?
I was born in a place called Mepham in Kent in southeast England. And Mepham is a village where the spelling is completely different to the pronunciation. So it's M-E-O-P-H-A-M, and it's surrounded by small towns and villages that similarly have names that are pronounced differently than they are spelt. So a very confusing area of the country to grow up.
Yeah, so that kind of clicks, because I, in all our conversations before, I've kind of thought there's a Britishness to the way you talk. And whilst I know you're not in Kent anymore, so tell us a little bit about where you are now.
So I'm in North Carolina now, in Durham. So there's some people know the Triangle District. It's very well known for medical device startups and a lot of entrepreneurial type stuff. And it's the Triangle because it's Raleigh, Durham, and I guess Chapel Hill is the third part of the Triangle. Now I come to think of it, I've never really thought about what the third part is. And it's a very sort of interesting area because it's very diverse in terms of the population, but also the activities down here, the kind of businesses that are here. There's a lot of schools, very well-known, well-respected schools, by which I mean, you know, colleges and universities in this area. And so it's really just a very sort of dynamic, interesting place to live. But I have lived in a few different places since I came to the States. So I came to the States in 1995 as a 2-year stint. I came over. I had to commit to 2 years because the organization that brought me over got me a visa. And so it was 2 years minimum. And I'm very glad I had that minimum, because after the first year, I was in New York, actually living in New York City and working in New York City. And after the first year, I was ready to go home. I did not feel that America was the place for me. I did not feel that New York City was the place for me. It was too busy and too fast and just overwhelming. But I had to stay another year. And that second year is when I sort of found my feet and found how much I loved the place. And then I moved out of New York City, sort of further upstate. And then I moved to Massachusetts. Most people, when they hear I was in Massachusetts, they say, oh, yes, I've been to Boston. I actually lived as far from Boston as I can be and still be in Massachusetts. So it's a long haul for me to go to Boston. And Massachusetts is a very sort of long, narrow state. And right. So it goes a long way. So I was actually closer to the New York border than I was to Boston. And then from Massachusetts, which I loved, we lived in a beautiful place. We just got to the point where there's just too much winter in Massachusetts, and we're getting more winter. We've had some really tough winter periods with lots of snow and lots of shoveling and lots of cold. We lived in a very old house that was kind of leaky, and it was kind of hard to maintain the temperature in either the winter or the summer. So we decided to move somewhere that's the weather's a little more temperate. So, and it's gorgeous. I love it down here. So,
wow. Sounds like you found your little bit in your thing. You found your niche, your ways suits you just right.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So the other, as you know, I've got the list of questions here. How about family? Are you family? I know you mentioned your husband to me once before.
And yes.
And your dog.
And the dog, yes. So that is Milo woofing in the background. I brought him into the office in the hopes that that would actually keep him quiet, but apparently it's had the opposite effect.
No, say hi to Milo from us.
Nigel says hello, Milo. So he's been a little overstimulated this weekend because we had lots of guests in the house, and so he loves it, but at the same time it just sort of gets him a little hyped up. So I have a sister who still lives in the UK. She lives in Wimbledon, and I have a nephew and two nieces and my brother-in-law. They all live over there. And then over here, I have my husband and two stepkids who are in their 30s, a son, a stepson and a stepdaughter, and then a grandson. So, and that's really the extent of my family now. I came from a very extended Irish family, but I lost touch with most of them a long time ago. And so, yeah, it's a small circle of family members that I have now.
Right. So you talk about your extended family when you were growing up. So where did you grow up? Was it Kent that you grew up?
Yes. And, so I was born and raised in Kent, born at home in the house and grew up in that house, lived there until I left home to go to university. I went to the University of Bath and studied economics. And then from there, I went to the London School of Economics to do a master's in economic theory. And then things just kind of, one thing led to another. I've been one of those people that just kind of follows the flow and sees what happens. I really admire people who have sort of a career goal, you know, and they take the steps towards it. I was talking to someone this weekend that was saying she knows what she wants to be doing in 2 years' time, and she, in order to get there, she has to do this now, and that will be 3 months of this, and then she's going to do something else. And she had this all mapped out, and I really admire that, but it's completely the opposite of me. I've just sort of gone from one thing to another thoughtfully, you know, as opportunities have arisen, I've given a lot of thought to whether or not I want to pursue them, but I've just followed those opportunities. And I've always seen life as being a little bit of a conveyor belt, you know, and the stuff goes past, and a lot of it we just let drift by. And then every so often, if we're attuned to it, we pick something off the conveyor belt, and it can be to do with mood. I think it applies to almost everybody. I know there are some people who have far less choices than I've had, and I'm very sort of mindful of that. But there is, people still have choices. I think they forget that they still have choices that they can make. And so I've just been very fortunate that I've had some good things come along on the conveyor belt, and more importantly, I've noticed them. So yeah. I've sort of grabbed them as they've come. And one of those was the opportunity to move to the States. I'd been over in 1992 running a pilot program at a bank. I was working for a software house and I was a programmer then. And that was the way I became a project manager, was that my project manager for that pilot site was actually effectively deported from the US.
Oh, right.
So the choice was they could either send someone from the UK from the software house to take over the project management and leave me in the position of doing the technical work, or they could ask me to do the project management because I already had a relationship with the client, and then send someone else to do the technical side. And that was what they asked me to do. They said, you seem pretty organized. You seem to sort of, you know, have a sensible head on your shoulders, and the client likes you. So it probably makes the most sense if you're willing for you to continue with the project management. And that is when I transitioned into project management. It's a very familiar story. I know engineers have done the same thing. I know other technologists who've sort of gravitated into project management, but I really sort of got into it. I liked it. I liked the breadth of dealing with stakeholders, the wide variety of stakeholders that really appealed to me, where when I was a programmer, I was dealing with a much narrower group of people. And so when it just sort of went, you know, one thing led to another. I was a project manager for 15 years before I even considered any kind of project management certification. So it's 2007 before I got my PMP with PMI, and I've kept that up. I personally haven't found very many situations where I needed to have the certification, but then having it, you know, it's, I don't know if I would have needed it if I didn't have it, if you see what I mean. So, and then anyone who's looked at my LinkedIn profile will know that I love to get education and I love certification. So it's no, you know, it's fine for me that I wanted to get a certification. So.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah. It's kind of got a similar sort of view on those sort of things. It's one of those things. It's like you go out in the rain and you haven't got an umbrella. That's if you go out without an umbrella, that's when it's going to rain, isn't it? So same sort of thing with certifications. If you're going out onto the job market or role market and you haven't got the certifications, that's when you're going to need them rather than right. Better right. to have them and not need them than not have them and need them.
Yes, exactly.
So just looping around there then. So as you say, that's a familiar story for a lot of PMs and project management people that I know, my personal story is very similar. But when you were growing up in Kent, in
Mepham,
I've written it down and I can't even say it. What was it you wanted to be then?
I had no idea. Something to do with math, I think, because I was always pretty good at that. But I was pretty nonspecific about what that looked like, you know, what a something to do with maths would be. I don't think I've ever really had a particularly long time horizon. So,
yeah, kind of goes with what you were saying before.
Yeah, exactly. I was always sort of looking to the next milestone, which I guess is maybe somewhat, you know, sort of aligns me with project management, but I was looking to the next milestone. How am I going to get there? And then I would reach that milestone and then I'd set the next one kind of thing. Yeah. A lot of the time in school, I was really following other people's plans. You know, there was this expectation that I would do O levels and that having done O levels, I would do A levels and that I would go to university. And it was, I was in my late teens before I woke up one morning and said, well, hang on a second, I've got to consider whether that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I've just, I don't recall having any specific thing that I dreamed of being when I grew up, including project manager. That it's not as though I woke up every morning and thought, wow, project manager, would that be a really cool thing to be? I just, you know, saw different opportunities and went for it. Sometimes I made decisions based on what I didn't want to do. Like I was working for an organization at one point and they outsourced our department and I was offered the opportunity to sort of partner up with a couple of people and start our own company. And I decided that I'd loved working with these people, but I didn't see us as a good fit for doing a startup. And so I walked away from that and had to find something else, you know. So sometimes it was walking away from something, sometimes it was walking towards something. But yeah, kind of opportunistic. That's been my style, I think.
Yeah. Take, grab whatever appears, as long as it works right. So how did you get into the economics and that? What made you make that decision?
So as I mentioned, I was very interested in math. I went through a period of time. This is a story that some people say to me, oh, you shouldn't tell this story. And then other people say, oh, you should tell this story because it will inspire others. So I went through a period of time in school where I was very disillusioned. I did in high school. And in particular, I wanted to study French at A level. And of course, you know, a lot of people who are listening to podcasts now don't even know what A levels are. But I wanted to do A level French, not particularly to get a qualification, but just because I loved the language and I really loved the French literature. And so I wanted to do this as a fourth A level with no particular concern about grades, not understanding at the time that, of course, schools don't want kids in classes that don't care about grades. Because that's obviously not going to be good for them and their statistics or whatever.
And it's not changed either.
No, I don't know. I think it's got worse, if anything.
Yeah,
and so there was a bit. I started doing the French class, and then a couple of other things came along, and I was doing some sort of extracurricular stuff, and the school said, you have to give up the French. And I spoke to my parents about it, and they said, yep, you have to give up the French. They all kind of agreed, and I just lost all interest in school. And mm-hmm. I was not as, I didn't attend as much as I probably could have done, let's put it that way. It was very cool because our bus used to draw up outside the back of the school, and the back of the school was out of sight of the teachers. And so sometimes I would just get off the bus and hightail it into town, and other times I would actually make it in and sign in and then just kind of walk out walk out the back gate and go about my business. So so I didn't get the grades in school to go and do a straight math degree somewhere, or not, certainly not a school that I wanted to go to. But I did get offered a place doing economics at Bath University, and they were piloting a class, a program that was much more mathematically oriented. So it was a lot of mathematical economics and modeling and sort of research-based stuff, doing econometrics. And I didn't have the grades to get onto that full class, but I could take all their classes as electives. And so I went to Bath, did a degree in economic theory, and then did all the electives with this other program, which was just, there were six people in that class at the time because it was a pilot, and six people plus me. And so it was the perfect sort of blend for me of doing, getting in somewhere that was a good school and, you know, a good program to be in, and at the same time gravitating towards the more mathematical topics. And so that's how I ended up with economics. And then I did well enough that my professor there said, you should really consider doing a master's in economics. You should go to the London School of Economics and do a master's there. So I was like, okay, that sounds interesting. So I'll go and do that, which was an amazing experience. Didn't really enjoy the degree so much, but I was in a class of 100 people from all over the world. I think there were only six people in my class that were actually from the UK. So I mixed with a great variety of people from elsewhere. And that was the most fascinating thing to me. I mean, I just reveled in this culture of, you know, a big mixed variety of culture. So that was me in economics. So
So then you said that you were a programmer. So did you go straight in from doing the university into that kind of role, or did you do
no.
a couple of roles in between?
No. I had a couple of roles where I was an economist. I worked for Cazenove, the stockbrokers in the city. And decided I didn't really like that lifestyle. Not for one thing, it was a very early morning lifestyle, and I'm not a morning person. So even at 20-something, I was not a morning person.
All right, fair enough.
And so I worked for a stockbroker. I worked for an organization that actually created econometric modeling software for people to use.
Right.
And then I worked for the Royal Institute of British Architects. And so I was the economist and did some of the sort of market research type stuff in that department. We were a department of three people that supported the Royal Institute of British Architects, and that was a really nice job. And then from there, I took an aptitude test at a company. Someone said to me, you should take the aptitude test at BIS, as they were called at the time, Business Information Systems, because they didn't require a computer science degree for you to go into programming. You just had to pass their aptitude test. So I took that and got in, and they did their own training course and everything. I learned RPG. Again, some people will never have heard of that, but it's an IBM mid-frame, mid-range programming language. And so I worked in that. And yeah, so then I spent, I guess that was 6 years, 5 or 6 years as a programmer. And I was on the help desk for a while, supporting clients that were using the software that we produced and stuff like that. So yeah, that and then I made that transition into project management and never looked back. So
It's obviously with that, did you that give you a with the BIS, did that give you a chance to work on quite a few different industries? And I guess with the project management, you probably worked across quite a few from the look of the intro I did.
Yeah, so actually the software house that I worked for was exclusively financial services. They specialized in foreign branches of banks. So it would be like if it was a German bank in New York, they used that software. It's called Midas. Right. And they had a lot of.
You know what? I used to work for Barclays, and when you said BIS, I'm sure I heard of Midas.
I heard of it. Yes, that's right. I remember Barclays being one of the clients. So
it rung a bell.
So what a coincidence. Yes, so I worked for them, and actually what I did was I became very specialized in one. It was a modular system, and I became very specialized in one module, which was the customer lending module. I pretty much knew that module inside out and upside down and backwards. And I was occasionally sent to clients, although I was on a help desk, I was occasionally sent to clients that were having challenges with the software and, you know, whether it was working for them. I remember I went to a brewery company, a beer brewing company, because they were using the software in a very different way. And so I was helping them figure out how to make it work for them. And I went to Madrid to BBV to help them address some issues they were having with the software out there and all of that kind of thing. So I was very much in financial services, which is how I made my transition to the US, is that I, you know, transitioned to banks. So I've done a lot of projects in financial services, some in, you mentioned state government and a nonprofit and various other places, but a lot of work in financial services and particularly in securities trading, which is what I moved on to, was actually securities trading systems became my thing. So.
Oh, wow. Sounds like really interesting and varied different roles that you've been in there.
Yeah. And that's been one of the beauties of just kind of following the thread, you know, and seeing what happens, is that I think I've enjoyed a lot more variety in what I do than I would have done if I'd set my sights on something. And variety is very important to me. I think that switching around, learning new things, I have a huge love of learning. And so going into something new and having to learn the new environment, the new systems, you know, the new, sometimes the new legal ramifications, regulatory stuff. I've done a lot of work with regulatory systems and stuff like that. So it's meant it's been very, although I say I'm in financial services, the variety of clients I've worked for and particularly the variety of projects I've worked on is enormous. So.
Cool. So talking about some of this, but I think you mentioned your project that you kind of stepped up on it, the how and why PMing sort of thing. And it's, as you say, it's a very common route that we take into project management, especially in the IT industry, from a programming point of view, and just someone saying, do you fancy managing that for me?
Right.
Well, tell me about that first project. What was it like?
Well, I was actually going to say that it's interesting that you bring up the thing about the sort of the accidental project manager or the person sort of stumbling into it, because I've been having conversations with people recently that are in different industries. Well, one person I've been talking to quite a lot is in the construction industry in major projects, large scale projects. And they've been pointing out to me that in some areas, project management is integrated into their training. So with an engineering degree or something like that, quite often there's a project management element built into the training and certification that they do. And it seems to be areas like IT where that project management piece isn't included in the sort of basic education of someone who's in IT. So that's, I'm sort of playing around with that idea in my head and trying to decide whether I agree that accidental project management is more common in IT than it is in other industries. And of course, IT is very young, so that may explain part of it.
I think it might, I think of it as interesting that because I did, as part of my training years back, I did part of the Open University BSc. They had one module which was on project management, which you could do, which allowed you, kind of gave you a step towards a certification. I can't remember all the details now. It was quite a long time ago. But that was within the computing degree that it was in there. But I think it does seem to be that that was a specific general computing degree rather than a lot of people didn't come into the IT industry not necessarily doing IT specific degrees, do they, either? You get a lot of grad recruitment programs that I see that where I work now, where you'll get people who aren't necessarily IT as being their first skill. It's just a general grad recruitment. So I mean, that's whereas, as you say, with the large engineering or the large construction programs, generally you need a relevant degree to get into those industries first, don't you?
Right, exactly. So it's an interesting question for me, and I'm really sort of playing around with it at the moment. And I've been, you mentioned that I post on social media. My favorite place to be is LinkedIn, and there've been a lot of really interesting discussions going on in the last few days about a couple of things. One is that whole question of, is project management a thing? You know, is project management actually a separate profession or skill set, or is it a profession or is it a skill set that's contained in something else? That's one thing that's been going on. And then the whole piece about process versus people, and how much do we want to be focusing on project management processes, and how much is it really about engagement and emotional intelligence and stuff like that? And all of those things are fascinating to me. But you asked me the question of how that first project was. The thing that was the most interesting to me about that project was the interaction with the people. That's why I found I liked project management, was because now my job was to take account of people's varying interests in terms of what was their interest in the project outcome, but also their level of interest in knowing what was going on with the project in the meantime. You know, how accessible were they if we had questions about their expectations of the project? There are some people who are right there with you answering questions. They kind of mentor you through, and business sponsors who are really engaged. There's endless things that people write about how the secret of success on a project is to have a really engaged sponsor. Excuse me. And then, you know, you've got these other people who want a particular outcome, but they really don't want to be bothered with the detail of the project along the way, you know, and then you've got everything in between. And navigating that turned out to be the thing that I was most interested in and most engaged with. And then, you know, I am a pretty organized person. I can keep a lot of things in my head. So from a practical point of view, the organization, task management, who's doing what, when are they supposed to deliver it? That was not too hard for me, even as I got onto much larger projects. So that side of it, when I was making that transition to that first project, this organizational side, I felt pretty good about. But the people side was both fascinating and really challenging to me, because I'd never had to do it before. You know, I'd been a programmer where someone would say, code this, you know, and then test it. Code it, test it, show it to someone. And so there wasn't so much interaction with people and taking account of other people's needs and wants and their communication styles and all of that kind of thing. So that was a fascinating transition for me.
So how did you go about that transition? What did you do to get yourself those new skills, obviously, that you were trying to learn?
So we do have to bear in mind that this is 25 years ago. So my recollection may be a little and if there's anyone out there that remembers me making that transition, you know, and they want to step up and say, no, that's not what she did at all, that's fine too. Really I focused on gathering as much information as I could from the people on the bank side. So we were piloting something. It was a software house piloting a new piece of software at the bank, and so we were kind of partnering with them. It's like a business partnership to develop some new part of the software. And so my focus was very much on what were they looking for? Why were they looking for it? You know, why did they need it? And in particular, how transferable was that? Because at the end of the day, as much as they might want something, the business client in a business partnership like that is looking for things to differentiate them from other people. And I think this is a big challenge with these kind of software partnerships that go on with a business and a software house working side by side to develop a piece of software, because the business interest is in differentiation and the software house interest is in homogeneity, because they want to sell it to other people. You don't want it to be too differentiated, because one of the problems is if you make it very differentiated as well, then your business client is going to say, well, that's ours, you know, it's our IP essentially, and you can't sell it to somebody else because then they lose their competitive advantage. And I've been on a few projects where there was that kind of partnership over the years, and I've seen that difficulty each time, is that I think there's quite a significant misunderstanding sometimes between the two partners as to what they're going to get out of the relationship and who's expecting what. And there's this constant tug. I felt this constant tug while I was on that project, from the client point of view saying, well, I want more, 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 because this is going to help me make my business more successful. And the software house saying, well, we want to minimize what we develop for you, you know, that is client specific, recognizing that you've partnered with us, so we need to give you something. And that tension is quite tough to navigate. And as I say, I think very often the two parties to that agreement are not fully aware that that tension exists. And so everybody thinks that they're going to get what they want at the end of the day, not realizing that it's not the same as their partner wants. And so that was really what I focused on a lot, was the sort of, I was always checking in with head office, you know, so the client wants this. Should I be building this? You know, should I be having the programmer program this? Or is that just too esoteric? Or is that too specific to them that it's something that we just wouldn't be able to market? And that was really what I focused on a great deal in that first project, and less on the task management side, because that seemed to run itself fairly well. As long as we were clear as to what the tasks were, the task management seemed to be quite straightforward. And I think that's pretty true on projects as well. I think the difficulty project managers have with task management is very often that we're not all clear what the tasks really are. And so there's, you know, that's when you have that sense of cat herding. I think if everybody's clear as to what the tasks are and what you're moving towards, most people are pretty self-sufficient and will get their work done. You know, most people have a sense of pride in their work. And somebody mentioned in something recently about project managers driving the project. I mentioned it in my book, actually, that I think if you're having to drive a project, and this can be semantics, but if you're having to drive a project, that's very high energy use for you. And it basically implies that people aren't behind it already. You know, you're having to push them towards something that is hard to accomplish. And I don't think we should be driving. I think we're supposed to be facilitating. You know, we're supposed to be removing obstacles so that people can get stuff done. And as long as those obstacles are removed, people will get stuff done, you know, because they know what they need to do. They have the expertise. You're usually using people who know their stuff, at least to some degree. And, you know, you're helping them make progress in the most efficient way. If you're having to stand behind them and say, you are doing this right, you are doing this right, well, then there's some problem there that probably needs to be addressed in a different way.
Yeah, you've either got the wrong people there, or you've got you're asking the wrong things, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
So, kind of leading on from that, what was the largest project that you've managed, and kind of what did you learn from that project? You define largest.
Yeah.
Whether that be money, people, complexity, change to culture, whatever is a definition, it's your project.
I suppose the answer I would have to give is that I can't define my largest project. I've worked on a lot of projects that are large in one form or another. So some have been large in terms of, especially working in the financial industry, some have been large in terms of the amount of money they would be pushing through the system. Yeah. So the actual implementation itself may be, you know, that might be like a, let's say, a $2, $3 million project. Mm-hmm. It might be more than that, might be an $8 million project. But it might be responsible for, on a daily basis, transferring, you know, $150 billion a day. So if it goes wrong, it's not the cost of the implementation that's the concern. It's the reputational cost to the client. So it's large in terms of reputational standing and their customer experience and all of that. So that's one version of large, I would say. I worked on one project where that was very much the case. We were switching out an old piece of software for doing securities trading for the new version of the software, which was very different. And so there was already a large client base using the existing software. And at the same time, the client I was working for was taking on a new function in financial services. So they were also creating a new product on this new platform. So they were doing all of them at the same time. And it was large because there were a large number of people within the bank impacted by this in one form or another and involved in testing and things like that. Because it was a foreign branch or a branch of a foreign bank, they had a lot of stuff that had to go back to head office. So there was a lot of interaction with head office. We had language challenges because we had some people in America, some people in Canada, some people in France. The head office was in France. So a lot of the work we were doing involved talking to people that officially the language was English, but very often it made more sense to talk in French to make sure that they really understood what we were asking them to do.
So your A level came in handy then.
The A level I never did.
That
was an amazing project. It was really, really very intensive, lots of long weeks and long nights and stuff like that, but a really great experience in terms of seeing how teams work really well together, taking account of different cultures because of the different locations. We were working with a vendor, and the vendor team, a lot of them were based in India. So it really was a multicultural project, which was very interesting. And also regulatory differences. I mean, people think of culture as you know, everything from religious practices to the food you eat to the practices you have at home, but also the regulatory framework. We're working in the US where basically people can be asked to work as many hours as they want up to a point. In France, they're very regulated about how many hours people can work, how much overtime they can do, when they can do that overtime. We were doing weekend work. They weren't supposed to do weekend work. So all of that sort of juggling of, and then you get into different holiday patterns as well. You know, they'd be, they have the grand vacances in August. And of course we slow down a bit in August, but not to the same degree. We had people in India who had their own holiday patterns and celebrating Diwali and things like that. And so it was really interesting to see how you integrate all of those people to work together. So that's one of the largest projects I've ever worked on. On the other hand, I've worked on a project where I personally had a team that was much larger. So that was me managing a various components within a very large project. And then on the other hand, I've worked where I led a team of 110 people. We were one program within a portfolio of programs, all supposedly marching in lockstep towards getting a whole new suite of systems implemented. And so that was large in a different way because of my my responsibility for 110 people in two locations, well, actually five locations, but country-wise in the US and in India. So dealing with time zone differences and all of that kind of stuff. So there's, I've experienced many different versions of large. The project I'm on right now is a very small team, but our email distribution list is a million people. So, you know, that's pretty large as well, right? So it's, large is just, who are you impacting? How are you, who are you interacting with? So.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the phrase large project there, I've left it in there as a kind of a, just as a discussion point, if nothing else, because it is, as you say, one person's large project is another person's quite small. And depending on the skills and team and what's going on in the different organizations sharing it will make a massive difference.
Right.
This one, I think, is less emotive, though. It's kind of, what is your biggest screw up and what did you learn?
I've never screwed up, so I can't really answer that question. What is my biggest screw up and what did I learn? Well, it's funny because I was interviewed recently by someone and they asked me something very similar. In my first job, the people who brought me over to the US in 1995, we were implementing a financial services product. And when we implemented it, there was something that I made a mistake on. Now, in the grand scheme of things, wasn't the worst mistake in the world. You know, no one's life was at risk or anything like that. There wasn't even, as it turned out, a huge financial risk either. But to me at the time, with my level of experience, it felt like a huge mess up. Now I look back and I'm sort of like, with my experience now, I would have sorted it out much more easily and much more smoothly. But at the time, it felt like a very large mistake. And the branch management of the company that I was working for were looking for who that person was that made that error. And they came, you know, hunting, witch hunting maybe. And my boss, who ran the IT department, said to management, "This is my team. They essentially do my bidding." I don't think he put it quite like that, but you know, that I am responsible for what they do. And whatever problem you have, you bring it to me. You know, the buck stops with me kind of thing. And the rest of it is, he essentially said, the rest of it is none of your business. You know, who it is within my team that made a mistake or didn't make a mistake or whatever it is you have to rely on me to take care of it appropriately. And that was a huge learning lesson for me that I carried with me. My father was like that as well. My father was someone who, it didn't matter what his staff did, it was on him, you know, he took it on the chin and then he would sort it out with them later. And my boss sorting it out involved him taking me into his office, which had glass walls on three sides, closing the blinds, you know, and letting rip and telling me that you can't make a mistake like that again kind of thing. Yeah. But I so appreciated that it was between him and me. And once he had told me what he thought and made recommendations on how to do things better in the future and had discussed with me what steps I was going to take to make sure that that kind of error didn't occur again, he was done with it. You know, he'd made his point and that was it kind of thing. And we were done. We carried on as normal. And I so appreciated that. And so I've really tried to incorporate that into every project that I've worked with, is that I am not going to jump all over you because of a failure or a mistake, or as long as we learn from it, you know, I will take it on the chin, and you have that protection. I think that is part of the role as a project manager, yeah, is absolutely to provide that sort of umbrella of protection for your team and let them do the work, let them do the experimentation. Experimentation, particularly in IT, you know, a lot of what I've been doing is IT projects. Particularly in IT, there has to be experimentation. You have to prototype. You have to do things that don't work to find the things that really do. And so that was a huge learning lesson for me to see that in action. Like I say, my father had sort of, my father was that way, but I never saw it in action live because, you know, I didn't work with him. But seeing my boss do that, I was like, yeah, that's the person I want to be. I want to be the person that doesn't ever throw anyone under the bus.
Yeah, I think it's that old adage that I've heard of the fact that if the project's going well, the team are doing a fantastic job. If the project's going badly, I'm the problem who's not getting the project delivered. And that's right. Kind of where you sit in that project role, don't you? The team are doing a great job. They're delivering it. But if something goes wrong, you're the one who needs to sort it out. Right. And you're right, it's that umbrella cover is there. Whilst having the stern conversations with the team and kind of encouraging them and teaching them and coaching them, it's a different thing. That's brilliant. So just leading on from there, kind of a bit more, look a little bit more positive. What was your, there's two questions I've got here. What was your proudest project delivery? So your project that you actually sat back at the end of it going, that was brilliant. And I absolutely felt so proud of me, my team, whatever it was that made you proud. And what was your proudest achievement that wasn't necessarily about a project delivery itself, but in relation to your projects?
Proudest delivery? I don't know. There are so many. That project that I talked about, which was for a French bank, one of the things that I loved so much in that was that we started out with a big problem in terms of testing because of turnaround times for the people in head office, that they couldn't, we would feed them files and they needed to feed back the results and they couldn't do it in less than, I can't remember exactly now. They told us it was a few days, like they couldn't turn it around in less than 4 days or something like that. And the team worked together to really analyze what the delays were and what the obstacles were to turning it around, and we got it down to 18 hours. So, and that really made a huge difference to our testing cycles and what we could test and how we could test and how accurate the testing was. So that, and just seeing the team come to that conclusion that there was another way of doing it and that they could make this work better, that was a huge one. Something similar happened to me on the project where I had 110 people on my project in India and the US, was we faced some similar challenges with testing timelines and testing schedules, and the team brainstormed and came up with a really creative way of refreshing the databases, you know, in much less time than they were when we started out. So those kind of things where people start out from a position of this is just how it is and we can't make it any better, and then they make it better anyway. I always love those moments. I think anytime we've delivered on, you know, the end of a project, the end product, there's always a sense of pride, because there's also that sense of pride that you survived it. I mean, I've worked on some very intense projects, and getting to the end of it and being able to say, well, we got that in and we did it. There've been a couple of projects where things have gone live and there's been quite a long period of sort of hand-holding and clean up afterwards, and getting to the end of that and being able to say, you know what, this is now running smoothly and everything is good. That's been fantastic. A couple of those projects, it was inevitable because we were switching one system out and putting a new system in, you know, sort of with the business already running. And so there's always that, some things can be converted, other things you kind of have to manually handle until everything is fully moved over. And so those things where we get through to the end and we're able to say, you know what, this is BAU now, those moments. So all of those, they all come down to, that for me, they always come down to seeing the team pull together and act as a team. I really, really love those moments. And then my personal moment of pride, I think the time that somebody said to me that I should write my book, It was someone from my team, actually a couple of people from the team that I was working with said, you know, you should write a book about this. And to have someone say that maybe I had something that was worth sharing, that was a moment of pride for me to hear that. So, and they spurred me on to do it. So, yeah, those are the ones, I think.
Sorry, I was just saying then to myself. Obviously, what you just said, there's a perfect segue into the fact that my next question about what made you start writing and blogging. So had you thought about writing and blogging before or anything like that before your team member mentioned it to you?
Not really. There were a few things that I did with the team, you know, that we did collectively that I made notes on, and I kind of wrote down what we'd done. Like at one point we did a survey to see what people's feeling was about how the team was working and what things were working and what weren't. And I made notes about how the survey worked for sort of for future reference. And then somebody outside my organization asked me about it. They said, because I was talking over dinner or something one day, and I said we'd had this feedback from team members. And they said, well, how did you get that feedback from team members? And they'd seen things like engagement surveys at the company level, but they'd not really seen a team do it on its own. And I'm sure lots of other people have done it. And I don't think, you know, we didn't invent anything new, but it wasn't something this person was familiar with. And I thought, oh, I should make a note of that in case anyone else ever asks about it. And so I started to note some things down. And then we did the work with character strengths, which I love so much. And that I definitely made, you know, I started to write a few things, not to share necessarily, but just for me to be able to remember what we did and how we created a team profile and how we discussed the team profile and all of that kind of stuff. So I started sort of noting things down with no particular plan of what I was going to do with them. And then, yeah, really what triggered it was, you know, a couple of people saying, well, write something. And I guess in the back of my mind, I thought, I hope one day I will have something to write about. You know, I liked the idea of actually writing a book about something, and I've always enjoyed. I did a law degree, and one of the things that I enjoyed about the law degree was I learned how to write in a very structured way, so that I could more effectively get my message across, kind of thing. So I'd had that idea. People say that everyone has one book in them, and I always hoped that one day I would have. I hope I've got more than one book, but I hoped I would get to that point, but I hadn't specifically thought about writing, and I hadn't specifically thought what it would be like to write something. So, yeah, they prompted that.
Now, how did you find that journey? The actual writing of it and going through the publishing and all that sort of stuff. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that? I think, am I right in saying that you've got the Project Motivator, and then there's another book that you did as well?
Well, so I'm a contributing author to a book about coaching. So there's a book called Coaching Perspectives 8, and it's a group of people each contributed a chapter on their thoughts about coaching or their experience of coaching and how coaching works, how it's beneficial and things. So I've got a chapter in that, which is actually about the similarities and dissimilarities between project management and coaching. And how coaching skills can benefit project managers. That's what my chapter is about. But the book itself, so the writing, I started off by doing what I think most people do is, you know, sort of writing in my spare time. And I found that it was hard because I would get maybe a few evenings where I'd get some writing done. And then if things got really hectic on my project, then it might be 5 or 6 or 7 weeks before I really felt like I had another time to do it. And people quite often said to me, well, just, you know, make sure you do 10 minutes a day, write something every day. And I never got into that habit. And so I was finding it difficult to sort of string the ideas together. And then for various reasons, I moved to a sort of different role within the organization I was working for. And then I came home and I said to my husband one day, you know, I think I would like to have a go at this of doing it properly, but I think I need to do it properly. You know, I need to take the time and just do the writing and see what happens. And he said, all right, well, so, you know, try it for a few months. So that's what I did. And then I was very fortunate that I made contacts with people who made suggestions in terms of how I might go about publishing it. And obviously one option was to self-publish. And then the other option was to find a publisher, which is notoriously difficult. And most publishers require that you go through an agent. So you don't just send your manuscript to them and say, hey, publish my book. You have an agent and they do the legwork for you. And that is no cheaper than self-publishing, which is, I think, partly why people do self-publish. Even if you hire someone to do all the sort of interior layout and everything of your book, you know, you're talking around, at the time I was talking around 10 grand to self-publish and 10 grand to get an agent and have them sort of take my book around. And somebody mentioned my publisher, Berit Kohler, and I had it up on a post-it note on my wall. And I knew I'd read some books by people who published through Berit Kohler, but I wasn't particularly familiar with them as a publisher. And then I went to a conference, and it happened that the one publisher that was selling books at the conference was the International Positive Psychology Association conference in Montreal in 2017. The one publisher that was there was Berit Kohler, and I was standing, I was waiting to buy one of the books, and I was standing there and I looked at the sign and I said, oh, Berit Kohler, I'm supposed to check you guys out. I didn't realize I was talking to the director of editing. And he said, oh, why, you know, why are you supposed to check us out? And I explained that someone had recommended them and that they thought that it might, they might be the kind of publisher that I should approach. So we had a meeting at the conference, you know, we carved out some time and met up over coffee and had a chat. And he said, you put in a proposal and everything, explained how to do it. And he said he would help me navigate the process, you know, of going through the proposal process. And it turned out that Berit Kohler had just acquired the arm of a consulting firm that used to publish project management books. They had acquired the project management arm, and they were looking for authors who could write stuff that kind of crossed over their current, their previous specialties, which was sort of business self-help, positive psychology sort of realm, and project management. And I said, oh, well, my book's kind of a combination of both. And so that just kicked off that conversation, and I sent in a proposal, and they assigned me an editor to help me figure out, sort of redo the proposal and make the case, and it got approved. And then it's an arduous, it's not something you take on lightly. I mean, I didn't realize how intense it was going to be, because you do lots and lots of writing, and then you send it to them, and various people review it, and they give you comments back, and then your editor will say something along the lines of, it's really nice, but, and the but is followed by the, you know, in my case, the 27 things that probably would benefit from being changed. So I went away and kind of rewrote a big chunk of the book and cut out parts that were superfluous or repetitive, and came back with a second draft. And they said, yep, this is much more, you know, aligned with what we think will be useful and popular. And I have to say, I much preferred the second version of the book. I'm really glad I had a really good editor, and I'm really glad that she made the comments she did, because it, I feel she really helped it become a much better book. And so that was that. And then you think you're done, you've written the book, you're the author, you've done all the writing and everything's grand, but you have to help decide what the cover's going to look like, because they want a cover that the author is going to really appreciate. And you have to look at edit after edit after edit until you never want to see your book again. And then they send you one more copy, you know, and say, just take a last look. And I was like, oh my God, it's got to be good enough at this point, you know, because I couldn't read it anymore. And then there's stuff like creating, there's going to be an audiobook. The audiobook will come out in April, where you there are certain parts of the book that can't be read as is, like you can't read a table.
No.
So they come back to the author and they say, can you write a script for the narrator to use to describe this part of the book? So now you're writing that. You have to get endorsements, you know, so you have to go to people and say, can you read my book ahead of time and say how much you like it? And that's on a time scale. So you can't just say, you know, get back to me when you've had time to read it. You need your endorsements by a certain point in time, and all of that. So there are all those steps that now I'm familiar with. I would plan differently, but they were totally unfamiliar to me, you know, in the first place. So it's a very interesting process. It's obviously another form of project. I've just been a project manager for someone else, for another organization that's producing a book. And I do think that my experience of writing my own book helped with that project management piece, because, you know, I know what the pieces are that are going to be upcoming. So, and I liked it very much. I enjoyed it very much. I hated it at times, and I hated it more because there were times when I just got stuck. You know, you owe some content and you're having a hard time coming up with it, you know, and there's a lot of research. I'm very much an evidence-based person, so I'm not writing a book that's just, I didn't want to write a book that was just my opinion. So I had to go back and verify my sources and make sure that my citations were right and all of that kind of stuff. So it's a pretty big project.
Yeah, but one that's been rewarding from the sound of it.
Yes, and I guess when you come back to that original question about what's one that you're proud of, I am proud that I got it done, and that I kept going and persevered with it, because the whole project is probably 2 years to get it to publication, and now there's post-publication, there's speaking and, getting the word out about it and stuff like that. So it doesn't stop on publication date. So
no, it just keeps going, doesn't it? And so the last few, I have a last few couple of questions, very quick fire ones. What was the last project related podcast you listened to? If you listen to podcasts, I don't know.
I listen to the podcast by Joe Poos, PMO Joe. He has one that's called Project Management Office Hours, and he's based in Tucson, Arizona. And they're very interesting. He gets pairs of project managers on, and then they talk a bit about their own topics. But what usually happens is he pairs them up quite well so that they're interested in some overlapping content. And then what usually happens is they start to sort of talk to each other, and he kind of is able to sit back, and the exchanges you hear between the two project managers can be really fascinating, because it kind of, one person will say something and it triggers an idea in the other one, and then, oh yeah, that's the, here are my thoughts on that. So I like that one. I'm trying to listen to more podcasts, and I've been looking for more. I know Elise Stevens, who's in Australia, she's got one which I'm going to start listening to, but I haven't yet. And there's a few, Andy Kaufman, I've listened to a few of Andy Kaufman's ones. He has some really great guests on as well. So
cool. Yeah. Cool. And what was the last project blog you read?
Define blog.
Written word on the internet. on a regular basis.
On a regular, oh, okay.
If so it's a LinkedIn post, if people blog on LinkedIn, if they blog on Facebook, or if they blog on their own website, whatever.
So I read something on LinkedIn every day. There's always something about project management. Because I like the discussions more than the blogs in that regard. I do read PM World 360. I'm a contributor now to that, but PM World 360 has a bunch of invited contributors, and we each contribute a blog or two a month. But because my interest is really more in the people side, I'm not so fascinated by there's a lot of stuff out there about project process, and I think there's a lot of people covering project process, and that is covered and is. I that's not my thing. A lot of the kind of blogs I read are actually more to do with behavioral science and engagement. So I read stuff that comes out by the Veer Institute on Character, which, in full disclosure, I'm actually their project manager at the moment. But I read stuff that they blog about. I read some of the research that comes out of Gallup, where they're talking about level of engagement and performance of managers in organizations. I read Harvard Business Review, a lot of content on there, and Forbes and stuff like that. So I'm more articles, I would say, than blogs. Okay. I don't so much follow individual people than themes. And so I'll go looking for people writing about the particular theme I'm interested in at the moment.
Search the hashtags and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. More of a hashtag girl than a people follower.
So couple of final questions. What top tip would you give to a PM who's out there now who wants to become a better PM?
I would say make sure your dog's not in your office.
Once. Milo doesn't like that question, does he?
All right, I think he's calm now. I've just pulled his hair, so that sort of triggered a sitting down, so that's good. Well, I think the tip I would give is don't get too tangled up in process. You need process and structure, But when it comes down to it, projects are about people. You know, people get projects done. Process doesn't get projects done. And so really paying attention to what do you bring to a project? What are the traits that you bring? What strengths do you have? And then what strengths do the people around you have? And really take a good look, because their strengths are not necessarily directly aligned with their function. So I have many, not to say that they're not good at their function, like I've had programmers, you know, been great programmers, but when you really sit down with them and explore their knowledge or explore their passion or explore their personality strengths, it turns out there are other things that they can contribute to the project that are really beneficial. And when you tap into those people become much more engaged because they feel so sort of seen and appreciated that they just do everything better. You know, they contribute more on all fronts in terms of their formal function and also the informal function of bringing their strengths to work.
Brilliant. I think I'm going to pop that to comment of people get projects done, processes don't get projects done on in the show notes as a highlight, because I think that's a great point. Really good. And the last question, and I'll let you get on with the rest of your day and give Milo some attention. What would you say if you were talking to you on that day when you've said yes to taking on that project when your other person's left the States? And you said, yes, I'll do it. What if you had a chance now to just say, tell yourself one thing, what would you say?
I would actually tell myself that there wasn't even reason to hesitate as long as I did. Grab it, do it, see where it goes.
Brilliant.
That would be it.
Thank you very much for your time today. You give me absolute loads of time and I really, really appreciate it. If people want to get hold of your book, I'll put some links in the show notes, etc. But if they want to follow you, where's the best place to get hold of you and follow you on social media and all those, or email or whatever, where you
Okay, well, contact? I'll definitely send you links. The best place to follow me in terms of what I'm saying about things is LinkedIn. I'm not a Facebook person. I used to be on Facebook and I have kind of disconnected from that. And I do, things show up on Twitter as well, but only as far as I share them from LinkedIn. So LinkedIn is where I'm very active. People are welcome to email me at Ruth Pearce, which is RUTHPEARCE, at projectmotivator.com. So they're welcome to email me with any questions or thoughts or suggestions, or and if people have suggestions about what the next book should be, I'm all up for that. And then I'm just about to launch a new website, which is also www.projectmotivator.com, and there'll be blogs on there, and there's also going to be, I'm gradually building up resources, free resources for project managers to use to be able to engage their teams and actually work with via character strength survey. So, yeah, so I am happy for people to contact me through any of those routes. And as I said, I will send you a set of links so that you have the most up-to-date ones.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
And buy the book. It's on Amazon, print and Kindle. And as I said, the audio book should be coming out mid-April as well, because I know a lot of people want to hear it, you know, as they're driving or whatever, they want to listen rather than read. So.
Yeah, I know the audio books are becoming more and more popular, and is rapid growth, isn't it, at the moment?
Yes, absolutely.
So thank you very much, as I said before, and have a wonderful, wonderful rest of the day.
Thank you, and thank you so much, Nigel. Have a lovely evening. Hope you have a nice, quiet, restful evening, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks, Ruth. Cheers now.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Another great sponsor of the show, it comes in the form of Air Manual. Air Manual is it's a tool for documenting process, which and best practices. It's run at, it's a company formed by a guy, one of my interviewees, Alexis Kingsbury. Essentially, and I kind of summarised why my view of where we see documentation, a lot of my experience has been, people will document something,
process. They'll put it in a Visio Dome that gets loaded onto a SharePoint site or something similar. And then a bunch of that. So then once that diagram's been shared with senior management, they're happy they have a process in the business. But then the detailed procedures underneath it might be in Word documents, in just poorly kept and not linked easily and not updated. And what Air Manual does, it allows you to put in it's a tool for doing this kind of thing. You whack it in, the service in there, get in there, put in your process, your flow, and you build it down to as low a level of detail, even to the point of checklists where people can check off they've done it. So it creates that guided checklists, easy to create, easy to maintain, and all in one place. And no one's kind of rooting around to find the SharePoint, and then when you change to new SharePoint services and all that stuff, it's all there. So if you pop along to nigelpreisser.com/airmanual, there's a bit more detail there and a link there to click on to go and get, I think they offer a trial and things like that. So it's something that I think can easily reduce the amount of errors, rework, etc. within our organisation. So take a look. I know you will have enjoyed that interview with Ruth. Her book, you can grab a copy of her book on the website. The concept of using strength-based skills rather than behaviour-based is really interesting for me. I'm sure it was for you. So enjoy. Have a great day. Bye. So this is my final wrap-up. Every week you're going to hear this, you're going to get bored of it, but you can always click next podcast if so. If you have enjoyed it, if you listen to this podcast to the end of this show and you think, that was great, I'd love to be able to help Nige out, there are loads of ways you can do it. The first and obvious way is to share the podcast, send it out to people. If you know colleagues and friends who'd benefit from it, you think they'd enjoy it, just send them the link. Grab one of the links, send them to www.nigelcreisser.com/podcasts. That's www.nigelcreisser.com/podcasts, and that will push them over to a Linktree link, and it's got all of the different ways they can consume the podcast. If you are feeling generous and have a big bag of cash, you could grab a copy of one of my books. Obviously, they're available in all the usual places, and print and digital. Again, jump on the website, www.nigelcreisser.com/shop, and that will give you a list of all the different ways that you can contribute and grab copies of the book. Also got links to all my guests' books on there as well, where I get a little bit of a kickback from them. If you are of a sporting mind, I have a number through doing some of my judo and running antics. I've managed to secure a few affiliate links and affiliates there as well. So in there, somewhere in the sponsors page, there's links to those as well. So clicking onto those and grabbing if you're looking to get super fit, then that would be fabulous as well, and I get a little kickback from those. I have a Patreon account. It's patreon.com/sundaylunchpm. So again, you can ping something in there, buy me a coffee or whatever. And finally, obviously the most important is coming back, listen again, because the more of you that come back, the more visibility I get, because there's more times that it's downloaded and all the SEO works and things like that. So yeah, that's it. So if you can help me out, I would be much appreciated. If you can't, don't worry about it. Thank you very much. Cheers now. Bye. My latest the latest affiliate that I've got on the show now is Riverside. I use Riverside to do my interviews, Riverside FM. It kind of offers you a whole, if you like, micro studio management producer tooling and goes beyond that. Has a really good free layer. And I've been using it for a while now. I find it really good. When I've had issues, even though I'm not on one of the higher paid levels, the support has been quick, responsive and of high quality, and people keen to help me. The organisation seems really good. The product seems really intuitive. And quality is really good as well. And it's a clever way of doing it is when you're recording through your browsers, so you've not got loads of desktop resources being used compared to some other products that I've used. And what they also do is they do they stream a lower quality version of it up onto as you're doing the interview, so you're not burning bandwidth while you're doing the interview and potentially impacting on the quality of the conversation. And then at the end, it uploads it, the higher quality from your browser. I mean, it's just a really good way of doing it. So if you are thinking of doing a podcast, know someone's doing a podcast, I would recommend using this tool. I found it really good. Best of the tools that I've tried using to date. And you can get that at nigelcreaser.com/riverside, and that will redirect you to my kickback page on their site, and there I will get a little kickback from them. So take a look. Thanks.
Well, it's goodbye from me, Nigel Creaser, and it's goodbye from him, the Sunday Lunch PM. Goodbye.